Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Corey Nostradamus, not Greiner.
But as you'll find out in a little bit, even Nostradamus wasn't Nostradamus.
And he might have got a D minus grade.
Exactly. A D minus minus, which is still passing, dang it. On today's episode, we are going to go over our 2020 security predictions that we made back in November of last year. And grade ourselves.
Wow, I gotta put, you sounded like Barbara Walter. 2020. Our 2020 predictions.
And we're gonna grade ourselves on how well we did. And with
on
that,
how well we enunciated 2020.
Let's get started before Corey finds something else to make fun of me for. So it is getting down to the end of 2020. Hooray, I think. I mean, 2021 can't be any less crazy, I suppose, or I guess any more crazy. And because it's coming down to the end of the year, it is time for us to take a look back at our predictions that we made at around this time last year. So if you're not familiar with them, every single year around November, December timeframe, we try and make a few security predictions on what we think is going to happen in the coming year. And sometimes they can be like a little extreme. I think it was 2 years ago we had one where it was hackers hold the internet hostage.
We had one years ago that was a hack would result in someone's death.
Yeah. But even if they do sound extreme, they're almost, well, not almost always, they are always grounded in some trend that we've seen in either our data or other people's data coming into the next year. So for example, that hold the internet hostage one was because there were many vulnerabilities in the routing protocols and the other protocols we use on the internet that someone could have potentially exploited. So coming into this year, we had 7 different predictions that touched on a range of different topics. And we're going to spend this episode going through each one, giving it a win or a fail or a meh, if we kind of got it 50-50, and then give a quick update on why we gave it those ratings.
And just to be clear, you said this, but this is for, it's hard to call it last year because we're still in 2020. But as you might guess, we'll be releasing, well, if you are on the website, you'll have seen we've already released our 2021 predictions. And we'll have a podcast on those going forward. But this is kind of judging our past, even though I guess the year hasn't ended. To be fair, we still have a month to hit on all of them, right, Mark?
Right. We'll just have to release an update if somehow the ones that we missed just magically happen in the next month and a half. Which, you know, considering how 2020 is gone.
You and I should get to work.
Yeah.
We can make it happen.
Who knows?
Are we willing to go to the dark side? I'm kidding.
I enjoy not being in prison, so I'm going to have to pass on that one. So let's get started with our first prediction from last year. So our first prediction's title was Ransomware Targets the Cloud. And this one was kind of piggybacking on a trend we've seen of ransomware targeting different sectors or different systems over the past few years. Like it all started, you know, the whole Dragnet style carpet bomb, send ransomware to everyone and hope you get some money out of it. And then over the past few years, it's become much more targeted, going after specific organizations or specific verticals. We've seen it go after managed service providers because of their elevated access, giving it then access to all of their customers. And so our prediction from 2019 into 2020 was that the next evolution for it, what it would be, it would be targeting cloud-based data storage and data backups. And this is also kind of grounded on the issues we've seen with insecure cloud storage, like Amazon S3 buckets, where we've seen countless issues over the past few years of data leakage, where we figured attackers might shift focus and go after that style of target.
Yeah, it's all about, you know, when attackers shifted from the shotgun ransomware to targeting industries or verticals. One, it was about targeting industries or verticals that needed uptime, but then they also targeted MSPs, and that's more about an aggregated target, finding a target that affects lots of different customers at once. And the cloud's a good example of it. So kind of makes sense that the cloud is a good target if you want to aggregate, you know, lots of potential victims at once.
So with that great explanation, Corey, how did we do on this prediction?
Yeah, I think this was a utter and complete fail. I will say, if you do a little searching for 2020, we weren't the only ones talking about this. There are some Security Boulevard articles, and I think a company called Rhino Security have been talking about S3 buckets specifically being targeted with ransomware. And I believe Rhino Security, I don't know if it's because they've seen any activity here, but they go through a full kind of how it would happen down to KMS encryption, what S3 objects it would target, what the attack path would be. So while we're not the only ones to kind of understand that this could have been a possibility, I simply didn't see it enough in the wild to call it a trend of any sort.
Yeah, and that's not to say that ransomware wasn't an issue in 2020, and it's not going to be an issue going forward. Like, it is still one of the biggest threats that organizations face. It's just, it's not currently targeting cloud storage buckets.
So interesting, could still happen. That's the fun thing. I mean, as Mark said,
that's the fun
we
thing.
Don't, I think these predictions always have long legs. You know, we're not any sort of, we're not Nostradamus, and Nostradamus wasn't even Nostradamus. None of us have a crystal ball or a time machine to know what's going to happen. Really, this is just to talk about the way real trends are evolving. So as you pointed out, ransomware is still a big deal. There's plenty of volume of ransomware. I would say the trend that did continue is targeted attacks, whether it be healthcare or manufacturing type industries. There's been countless big targeted ransomware attacks, and everything that makes the cloud a potential sexy target to a bad guy still exists. I will say some of the things that kind of put this prediction down a bit is when we said the cloud, we supposed S3, any sort of data bucket's a good possibility, but we said the cloud in general. I will say one thing that makes this prediction harder to ever come true is that, like, if you have assets in the cloud, often there's a lot of virtualization, which means you have copies of data that you can spin up, which really comes down to you might have existing backups that a recovery from ransomware is just spinning up an old copy of something. So there may be reasons why targeting the cloud isn't that great a idea, but I do think, you know, as we said, the point of these predictions is to pay attention to the underlying trends. And it's also, some of our predictions do come true 2 or 3 years after we make them. So we may not hit the year exactly, but you should still watch out for your cloud assets and secure your S3 buckets at the very least.
Yep, especially if they're sexy buckets.
I love me some sexy buckets.
So
the ones full to the brim with water just leaking over the top. Those buckets are so sexy.
Brilliant. Let's move on to the next one. So our second prediction from last year was GDPR comes to the United States. So GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation out of the European Union, came into effect back in 2018, and it brought with it a lot of really good privacy protections for individuals. Basically, you as an individual have control of your data now. You get to see who uses it, how they use it, who they share it with, and you have the right to be forgotten as well and request them delete that data. And there are some pretty steep penalties for companies that fall out of compliance with GDPR. And so our prediction was we wouldn't necessarily see a federal level GDPR bill passed in the United States, but it would come to at least several more states within the union. This was after in 2019 when California's consumer protection, what was it, CCPA, Consumer Something Protection Act, came into effect. And then also when the New York Shield went into effect in 2020 after passing the previous year as well. So Corey, how did we do on this one?
So also a fail. There were no new ones. And like you said, we, because of things like CCP, California Consumer Privacy Act, we thought other states would follow suit. I do think, and by the way, we specifically, as you said that maybe up to 10 states would do it because we had no faith that the federal government could do it. I don't want to, everyone's probably sick of politics, but the state of federal politics meant the Congress really couldn't pass anything right now. So it was up to the states. So we did fail because I saw no laws. I will say, I think there's an unusual justification that helps this failure in that I think that COVID happened. I think states, while states weren't as gridlocked as maybe the federal government with politics, I think states have had their hands full since March dealing with other things. So haven't done any research on this, but I just bet general new state law has kind of taken the back burner other than COVID-related reactions, think like stimulus and small business things. So we did fail. There really is nothing new to report here as far as other states having new privacy acts. But I do think 2020 was a year of consumer concern with privacy. We're starting to really realize, especially with social media, the ramifications of privacy. In fact, I've been recommending it to everyone, and I suddenly forget the name. Oh, The Social Dilemma. There's a Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma that talks about the algorithms and how they guide us once we share our personal information. Very interesting documentary. I recommend folks watch, although it's kind of scary too. But I think despite the fact that we failed, we're going to see a big focus on privacy. And this is one that has a high chance of coming true, I think inevitably at some point. And I'll even hint that we have more privacy-related predictions next year.
Yep. And the good news is that even if you aren't a California resident, just by virtue of them being, as a state, one of the largest economies in the world, that websites and organizations now have to cater to who their privacy bill for. Like when it comes to things like that, in general, it's less expensive for a company to just enact the whole thing across their whole customer base versus having a California version versus a rest of the United States version. Like we see the same things with like highway emission standards and other big legislation that comes out of California that just becomes a de facto standard across the country and across the world. And we've seen this in quite a few places too with the California Consumer Privacy Act, where because any business that it does business with a California resident has to follow the standard, and now New York as well with the SHIELD Act, it's basically a lot of other people benefit from it as well, even if they aren't a California resident, just because the additional privacy requirements and privacy features are rolled into these services now.
I will say, by the way, just since we're talking about GDPR, while our prediction didn't hit, there are more U.S. effects with GDPR. As you know, GDPR is a European law, but any U.S. business doing business with Europeans has to abide by it. And one of the things that some U.S. companies have been relying on is there's this concept of privacy shield. It's a federal government like agreement with European countries that existed before GDPR. And Privacy Shield was one of the ways that, at least on paper, allowed certain U.S. companies, it is similar to something called Safe Harbor, to be able to share information from Europe with, you know, under the law. But one of the things that happened was in 2020 was the Privacy Shield was invalidated as a way to kind of conform to GDPR. So while we didn't see the U.S. state laws that introducing our own GDPR, we are seeing GDPR getting more strict with U.S. countries and companies.
So we are, what, 0 for 2 now? Not a good start to these predictions.
Nope. I think at our best we've gotten about 75%, and we're usually above 50, but so far we'd need a lot to catch up.
Yeah. So let's move on to the next one, which was titled Voter Registration Targeted During the 2020 Elections. And this prediction came out of us trying to figure out what someone might actually target for this election in order to potentially interfere or change the outcome in some way. And Corey and I are both pretty much in agreement that you're not going to go hack a voting machine. It would be too conspicuous. It'd be too difficult to do on a mass enough scale in order to actually affect an election. And why would you do something so overt when there are other ways to potentially interfere or change an election's outcome?
We've also said it before, by the way, that you can hack voting machines. They're definitely not invulnerable. They've had vulnerabilities before. So this is us not saying that it's impossible to hack voting machines. It's just us saying it's not necessarily the right target. Even if you could pick a particular state that's valuable as an electoral college state for some reason, there's just easier ways to do it. So don't think we're saying it's not possible. We just did not think it was a likely target at all this year.
And instead, we figure that if someone were to try and potentially interfere or at least hack into something related to the election, they would go after voter registration databases instead. Because instead of changing votes, if you can simply prevent people from voting or make their votes not count, which as we've seen now after the election, like there's pretty big attempts just to make that happen in general. And everything came under scrutiny.
It seems like you don't need external state-sponsored actors to do that. You can have domestic actors try to do that themselves.
But with everything under a microscope, if someone were to have been able to change like someone's address, for example, it suddenly throws that vote into doubt and it could potentially be thrown out. So that's where our prediction came about, where people would instead target those registration databases instead. So, Corey, how did we do on this one?
So I think this one is a win. Well, by the way, we don't think this affected the vote in any way. As the ex-head of the CISA said, this is the most secure election we've had in history. The attempts, the external state-sponsored attempts at manipulating the election were targeting voter registration databases. For instance, there's a lot of news around them using old stolen voter information they had from other years. But this year, even the FBI and the CISA issued an alert that Iran had hacked voter registration information in at least one state and apparently used it to send out individuals in that database intimidating emails, basically trying to get them to vote for Trump.
Yeah, they like spoofed them to be coming from the Proud Boys organization saying, you better vote for Trump or else we're going to come get you. And you can see if you got one of those emails why it might be frightening to some individuals and it might cause them to consider not voting.
And by the way, I'll let you get to the other example, but it's a perfect example of disinformation, which we talked about with Nina Jankowicz. The Proud Boys exists. And by the way, the Proud Boys clearly support Trump, but this state-sponsored Iranian nation-state actor can do this false flag. You know, they don't have to give us false information. They just have to take things that are happening in our country and use it to stir up misinformation and disinformation to intimidate people.
Yep, and there is even another example too, though less of a, you know, nation-state hacking into a state's voter registration, more of just a borderline prank that is still super illegal. There was actually an individual in Florida who, quote unquote, hacked, but really just used publicly available information to change the voter registration address for Florida's Governor DeSantis. And while this is like, I mean, honestly, I found it a little funny. It was a mild inconvenience for the governor. They got it fixed and the guy got arrested because it was illegal. It does point to a flaw in the voter registration systems that a lot of states use. Like I looked into it in Washington. You can invalidate someone's ballot by printing one, and all you need in order to do that is their date of birth, their address, and their name, like no other additional info. And so potentially you could target certain counties and certain swing states and, again, deregister voters by changing their info or requesting additional ballots and cause issues.
And by the way, it's good it was a prank because I presume one of the few reasons it was caught is because they targeted this official government dude. But if he had done that on a mass level to general people, they probably wouldn't have figured it out until they go into vote and they have the wrong address or something and their vote gets invalidated. So I think it's a good example of how you don't need to change the election just by manipulating voter registration. You can have a big effect on election results.
And yeah, you don't even need to go in and like deregister every single Democrat or every Republican. Like if you can, some of these like counties and some of these states are decided by a very small margin of votes. And if you can just pick off a few here and there in different counties or different states, you could potentially have a impact on the outcome of the election. So I don't think like, obviously, our next in the States, we don't really have to worry about this for another 2 years for the next major federal election. I don't think that this as a topic is going to go away because I also don't trust that states are going to take action to better secure the registration databases. So that makes us one for two. Hooray. We're still failing, but at least we're doing a little bit better. And our next prediction was titled The Cybersecurity Skills Gap Widens. And this was built off of reporting over the past 2 years that shows that there is a large number of unfilled positions in the cybersecurity industry. Basically, there is a skills gap, as they call it, of, I think at the time of the prediction, around 3 million unfilled jobs So that's organizations, companies, businesses, service providers that need security professionals in some form and simply can't find them, either because they're gobbled up by other companies or because they just don't exist. And it's been a pretty serious issue for a lot of organizations. Like, if you can't get talented security people, you potentially put yourself at risk for cybersecurity threats. And so our prediction was, I mean, it feels kind of like a gimme, but our prediction was that that skills gap was going to continue growing.
Yeah, and by the way, to just give some statistics of before our prediction, I can't remember if it was the cybersecurity, what's the name of the company? I think Cybersecurity Ventures, the analysis said around 2018, 2019, there's something like 2.89, so just under 3 million global unfilled cybersecurity predictions. So that was the before.
Yep. And so how did we do on this prediction, Corey?
So like, yeah, I think you gave it away by mentioning a give me. I think we were always, this is kind of a softer prediction in that we saw this trend and we know it's going to continue. And it has. I mean, they have upped that number for 2021 to be 3.5 million open cybersecurity positions. So this is a win. It's unfortunate for companies, though, because if you are looking for any sort of expertise to help you secure your organization, it's a lot harder to come by. I will say the good news, I guess, for cybersecurity professionals listening to the podcast is there is currently zero unemployment rate in cybersecurity, which means we all have plenty of jobs. And there, by the way, there's been zero unemployment in cybersecurity for the past 8 years, according to Cybersecurity Ventures.
Yeah.
So it does look like it's a industry that, one, it does have some pretty technical skills in some cases. So you do have to get good people, but perhaps it needs some better marketing to get the newer, younger generation to dive into this really cool, interesting field that's going to be around for quite a while.
Yeah. And until then, like, this is where partnering with like a managed security service provider can be of good benefit for your company. Like, if you can't hire a security professional, work with someone that has security professionals on staff so that you have all your bases covered. And I will say, like, I like what you mentioned, like, we need maybe marketing or at least more like working with universities to try and get people interested in cybersecurity, or even at a younger age. I spoke at like a Zoom conference for a high school team at one point relatively recently, and I think I turned every single one of them into hackers after that talk, just because you really need to get people into this industry. We have so many jobs that need filled in it.
Yeah, and I think it's a fun and interesting. I think it sometimes gets a false expectation of, one, being tough because there's a lot of technical knowledge, but two, being scary because you assume you're accountable. So when things go wrong, it's your fault. But there's actually a very diverse amount of different types of cybersecurity jobs. I mean, hey, if you're lucky, you even get to do fun podcasts and neat presentations and do CTFs with cool badges. So there's a lot of cool jobs associated to this industry. Not all have the same technical requirements. So, and it really is an interesting field. If you like puzzles, if you like solving neat mysteries, there's a lot of validation in this, and you're of course doing something that's for the good of society. So I would love to see the industry grow.
Same. So we're 2 for 2 now. Does that make us?
Yeah, 50%.
Which
maybe the D territory, D minus territory.
And the world of predictions is at least passing. So our next prediction was, in 25% of all breaches will happen outside the perimeter. And this was, man, kind of giving it away now in retrospect, a gimme, but this was obviously pre-pandemic times where we were basically saying attackers would start shifting their focus towards the endpoint, towards the individual as they worked from home or transitioned to working from home and coming into the office.
In November 2019, the pandemic was not on our mind. While it might have been in Wuhan then, I don't think it was in our news until late December, January.
Yeah. And so, Corey, how did we do on this prediction?
Yeah, this is a super win. By the way, just to share the why around this prediction, it's remote work. The trend of remote work is increasing no matter how you look at it. We had pre-pandemic surveys we did with partners that show that, you know, all companies have at least 50% of their employees work outside the organization around 80% of the time. So people were working in lots of different places. The cloud and other ways we put our data in different places just means the perimeter is it still exists in many different places, but it's more porous and there's a lot more of it. So the prediction was based on that. But I think it's a win. It's hard to find. We have a few quantifiable things, but globally, it's hard to say for sure every single breach happened inside or outside. But based on some data we're going to share, there were a lot more attacks that targeted folks outside their office perimeter. And we really believe COVID kind of made this a give me in that lots of tech or knowledge-based businesses, almost all their staff is outside the perimeter and is working home at home. So if you're targeting users, that's the only place you could have got to them.
Yeah, like Malwarebytes put out a report late into this year, relatively recently, where they found that 20% of organizations that were surveyed in this report had a breach because of remote workers. Like, there is data backing it up that as we are working from home and as we quickly spun up this work from home infrastructure across much of the world, like some companies got it wrong or had some blind spots and it enabled cyber intrusions and data breaches because of this remote work workforce.
Yeah, and some quantifiable, but let's talk about it anecdotally, evidence is if you listen to our quarterly internet security report we give a lot, that report's mostly based on our network-based security and Firebox. And malware has been down since the work from home started. And we believe that simply because all the people that, you know, users are targeted with malware and they're no longer behind the fireboxes. Meanwhile, you might have heard in our past podcast, we acquired an endpoint security company, Panda, and Panda continues to block lots and lots of threats and is actually kind of growing because of the pandemic. So there's definitely quantifiable evidence showing that network-based malware is down, probably because users are leaving. And what we see on the endpoint suggests, you know, the endpoint security at home is where a lot of the action's happening.
Yep. Man, we are on a roll now. 3 for 2. Starting to pick it back up. This is good.
I think we might have a C.
Exactly. Let's move on to the next prediction then, which was vulnerabilities in the 5G Wi-Fi handover. And this one came from some research in, I think it was early 2019, into the very new 5G rollout. And some researchers found different vulnerabilities in the protocol itself and the handling of the protocol. But our prediction was in regards to a mechanism in 5G that enables carriers to basically hand off cellular and data connections from the 5G network onto Wi-Fi. We predicted that researchers would target this handover and find some vulnerabilities sometime throughout the year.
And the theory behind this is a lot of the cellular vulnerabilities you see in general have to do with some sort of downgrade. You know, in some cases, it's a downgrade from your newer 5G to 4G or 3G. You know, maybe you come into a spot that has older technology, so your phone has to hand off a downgrade to this lower mechanism, which might not have the best security because it's 3G, or maybe the downgrade mechanism itself, there's something you could do to force it to downgrade to something it shouldn't. And the handoff that 5G does to Wi-Fi at a carrier level is a similar type of handoff. You know, it's just a mechanism that seems to have a lot of attack surface and potential for attackers to force you to not use security mechanisms that a more modern technology might have. So that was what we thought. And of course, the previous handshake vulnerability from 2019 leaned us further into that idea.
So how did we do on this one then, Corey?
This is such a fail. I don't think we have anything to talk about even. I mean, I can't even find examples of something.
There really have not been many research discoveries in terms of security discoveries in 5G in 2020. Apparently they caused vaccines to activate and give people COVID, but that was just about it.
You beat me to it. That's definitely what I was going to say. 5G is responsible for the whole fall of society and the spread of COVID.
Yeah, but that's just about it. So unfortunately, that puts us back under or back to 50%. We're at 3-3 with just one prediction left. And this prediction was multi-factor authentication becomes a standard for mid-size companies. And this one came about from just the fact that MFA has been growing year after year. But for the longest time, it was kind of priced out of range for small and mid-size enterprises. You needed either expensive hardware tokens that you had to send out to all your employees or expensive servers infrastructure on your network to handle it. But over the past few years, that cost has really come down thanks to cloud-based MFA. It's made it easy to manage, easy to deploy, and easy to use for even small and medium businesses that don't necessarily have a security team.
And mobile devices, the fact that your token is something companies already have.
Exactly. So our prediction was that it becomes the standard for mid-sized companies in 2020. And Corey, how did we do on that one?
So I guess we could go meh on this. In that it's actually hard to find any supporting quantifiable information one way or the other. One thing I can tell you is again, thanks to COVID, I do think MFA is up for sure. Many more companies are talking about it. Many more are using it. When you have remote employees, your digital authentication becomes your primary and only validation of users. So that's why MFA is so important. But I think the key word there is standard. By saying the bold prediction of it becomes standard, meaning all mid-sized companies just do it, as table stakes de facto, I have to admit that that is probably a fail. I think there's probably a lot of green fields. And one thing that maybe this is how we judge ourselves. If you were to ask me, do all mid-sized companies use MFA? The answer would probably be yes. In that they probably have one or two privileged users or one or two privileged processes that just for those things they use MFA. But when we say standard, we mean all employees. We kind of mean it should be enterprise-wide. It should be everyone. And that's something I think is not happened even among mid-sized organizations, let alone small businesses.
Well, 2020 was a pretty crazy year, so I don't want to get too down on ourselves, and I am going to go ahead and give this a meh. Just so we can keep that 50-50% there going forward.
that would literally give us 50-50.
Yep.
But I will admit, this has not been our best year. We've actually had a better batting average for the past 2 years than this one. But of course, we got a little bold with a few of them. Sometimes it's no fun if you give general trends that you know will hit. It's more fun to give the specific ones, like attacking 5G handover. But of course, that makes the success rate a little smaller.
Yep. So as you are listening to this podcast, our 2021 predictions are already out at watchguard.com/predictions. We'll probably chat about them on our next podcast, I'm assuming will be our best bet for that. But if you want a sneak peek, you can go check them out there. And if you want to hear the details on why we picked them, you can stay tuned for our next podcast episode. So overall, 50%, you know what? That's a... It's passing in my book. I'll take it.
For a dumpster fire of a year, that's like good news.
Exactly. Dumpster fire of a year. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #the443podcast. Thanks again for listening, and you will hear from us next week.
Hey guys, and if you have any predictions of your own, use that 443 podcast hashtag. If we see a prediction, we'll talk about it on an episode.
Great idea. Hashtag it up.
Hashtag, hashtag. Hashtag make a fleek. It disappears in 24 hours. Okay. Is that the name of the new tweet?
I have no idea.
We need a 443 podcast fleek hashtag. Tell us something we don't want to know and it will disappear right after you fleek it.
All right. Hashtag end recording.